please the court. My name is Lee Drury. I represent Raheem Johnson, and I'm from Lynchburg. I apologize if I seem a little slow this morning. I'll try to pick it up as matters go along. And I also appreciate being invited back to try to again convince you that the position that Mr. Johnson takes is the correct position, that the trial judge made an error in not granting him his request for the appointment of a neuropsychologist.
Counsel, preliminarily, one of the reasons that I specifically wanted you to be invited back was because I wanted to hear an argument on the Supreme Court's recent case in Montgomery. Would you be kind enough to explain how your theory of why Montgomery is not part of your argument?
Well, Judge, I think Montgomery is part of my argument. A lot has taken place in the past several months, and it took me a long time to digest Montgomery. And with the help of a fine attorney here in Richmond by the name of David Hargett, I think I was ultimately able to find the key provision of Montgomery versus Louisiana. I believe I'm citing 136 Supreme Court 718 at about page 735, where the Supreme Court said there are instances in which a substantive change in the law must be attended by a procedure that enables a prisoner to show that he falls within the category of persons whom the law may no longer punish. And it cites the Mackey, 401 U.S. The court goes on to say, in a similar vein, when the Constitution prohibits a particular form of punishment for a class of persons, an affected prisoner receives a procedure through which he can show that he belongs to the protected class. And at that point, it cites Atkins versus Virginia. When we made the request for the appointment of a neuropsychologist, I specifically cited to Virginia Code Annotated 19.2-299. That code section mandates the preparation of a pre-sentence report. It also allows for the development of additional relevant factors. And when you back up to Miller, which was decided 4 weeks before the trial in Mr. Johnson's case, it's clear that youth, that individuals younger than 18, are in a protected class. They have risen, the case law demonstrates that there are two things different within the law. Death is different, and youth is different. And youth is particularly different when you're dealing with sentencing. And that impacts the need for individuality and proportionality.
If neither Miller nor Montgomery applied to your client, would you still have articulated a particularized need?
I believe I would have, Your Honor, because even before Miller and Montgomery, Roper and the other cases dealing with juveniles made it clear that juveniles are different.
So would that mean that in any case where we're sentencing a juvenile and they're subject to a sentence of 20 years or more, they would all be entitled to a neuropsychologist or psychiatrist?
I don't think 20 years is the magic number, and I'm not sure that I have a magic number.
Well, your client was subject to 20 to life, correct?
At least.
Right.
Yes, ma'am.
And so would we, if we granted your request, be establishing a rule that where a juvenile is facing 20 years or more, they are entitled to
a specialist? I don't think that this court would necessarily be establishing any rule. I think what this court would be is fleshing out the rule already established by the United States Supreme Court requiring individuality and proportionality.
But doesn't that apply in the context of Montgomery and Miller to life sentences without parole? At a minimum, life sentences without parole.
I would agree with that, Your Honor, that at a minimum it applies to life sentences. And I would even deviate from...
Well, it has to be life sentence without parole because the Supreme Court told us giving Miller retroactive effect, moreover, does not require a state to relitigate sentences, let alone convictions, in every case where a juvenile offender received life without parole. They go on to say that if they're eligible for parole, no resentencing would be required.
Well, Your Honor, the problem is that Virginia is a unique duck.
Mm-hmm.
We have what's called geriatric parole. And yet, there is evidence in this particular record at page 216 of the appendix where in 2011 there were 719 inmates eligible for early release under geriatric parole and only 0.4% of them received it, which means only 3 out of 719 inmates.
We've dealt with that before. Here's the challenge within that statistic. As of today, everyone who is eligible for geriatric parole, or the huge majority of individuals who are eligible for geriatric parole, were also eligible for regular parole because they were convicted under the pre-1995-1996 standards. So already the best candidates for parole have potentially been washed out of the system. And so you can't yet say, well, only 3% were granted geriatric parole because it's a different population than it will be 10 years or 20 years or 30 years from now.
No doubt, Your Honor. But I believe that the case eludes me, but I believe there were two justices of this court that questioned the whether or not that view of the possibility of geriatric parole had any remaining vitality in light of the move of the U.S. Supreme Court concerning youth and sentencing.
Well, so I'm very familiar with those two justices. In fact, I'm really quite fond of one of them.
Well, you mean.
And that would be Justice Goodwin. The difficulty is that our hands are tied behind our back without Montgomery being cited in your brief, to be quite frank.
Which brings me to my question.
And which brings us to his question.
I want you to try to do this. And you were invited by the court, properly so, to address Montgomery. I'm going to invite you to address the issue without Montgomery and deal with it only under Husky. Under Husky, did the trial court err in not providing a neuropsychologist on the facts of this case? If you can make that case, then you don't have to get into this argument about Montgomery, and that's why I'm asking you to do it without Montgomery.
Well, Judge, I think that if I start with Miller, which is where I've started...
No. I don't want you to start with Miller, and I don't want you to start with Montgomery. I want you to deal with Husky. Under our decision in Husky about the standard for appointing experts, can you make the case? And don't think this is a hostile question. This is not a hostile question. This is a friendly question.
Can you make
the case without Montgomery or Miller?
I think I can. And I think that the argument comes down to social science has developed in such a fashion as to show that the brain does not fully mature, develop, finish all of the pruning to be a fully functional machine, to be a fully functional operation.
And you did provide that information to the trial judge, at least in articles and things of that nature that say exactly that.
And to take it the next step further, Judge, all judges, whether they sit at the appellate level or the trial level, are expert in only one thing, the law, and how to apply the law to the facts before them. In order to understand social science, we would submit that you need an expert in the field of social science that can interpret the very material, the very cases, case studies, and other research that is cited by the Supreme Court in Miller, in Montgomery, and for that matter, Roper and all the others. And until that complex social theory has been distilled and applied, and not only distilled so they can be explained and understood in a general concept, but it also has to be explained and understood with specificity to the client. And therefore, the neuropsychologist could provide both the expertise to define and distill the general stuff, and then also take and define and apply the general to the specific, which is Mr. Johnson.
Counsel, have you answered your question? I don't want to diminish the level of sentence that your client was facing, but why wouldn't that argument apply equally well as well to a Chen's petition? You have a juvenile in any proceeding where you're telling the judge, Judge, you cannot understand the psyche of this child unless you appoint a neuropsychologist to tell you why they did whatever they did. First part of the question. It seems that the Supreme Court drew the line at it is important for you to have this expert in a case where a child is facing life without parole. But your argument would seem to just say, where you have a child, you have a judge who's experienced in the law, the judge needs an expert to tell them how to deal with that child. Where is the line?
Judge, unfortunately, I have not taken the necessary time to define that line. And I've not done that primarily because my primary focus has been on my client. My client requires me to advocate that he was denied a fundamental tool to advance his case. And I would submit that not only does Husky allow the appointment of neuropsychologists, but that in the appropriate case, when you're dealing with applying these experts to an individual that faces a possible life sentence, that there is a reason to appoint in this particular case. Now, I will recognize that there may be a time in the future when I may have to stand here and say, I made a mistake, I shouldn't have asked for it, I withdraw it, dismiss my appeal. I hope I don't come to that time, but anything's possible. I hate the punt, but I don't know that it's my job to define where that line is, Justice Powell, and apologize for punting in such a situation. Your Honors, I understand that perhaps I am not the greatest appellate lawyer in the world, and perhaps maybe I made a procedural default. But I would submit that in my reply brief that I addressed the issue raised by the Attorney General concerning not citing to Montgomery until the reply brief. I would also point the court, like when I said that this has been a busy situation, I would point the court to United States of America versus Gary Johnson, opinion issued by Judge Norman Moon out of Lynchburg on June 28, 2016, which I think was a day or two after my deadline. And I would submit that what Judge Moon has done is exactly what is within Montgomery, that Virginia in this situation had a procedure that allowed Mr. Johnson a way to help the trial judge form a particular, proportionate, rational sentence, taking into account all of the factors in Miller that were argued from the beginning, and asked the court to reverse and sentence to within the guidelines, or at the minimum reverse for a new sentencing hearing. I believe I've used all of my time, and I appreciate your patience.
Thank you very much.
Good morning. Good afternoon, I think it is. May it please the court, Donald Jeffrey on behalf of the Commonwealth.
Mr. Jeffrey,
yes, sir.
Now that you've identified yourself for the recording, you handle your time any way you want to. That's your prerogative. But I want, at some point in time in your argument, for you to address why Montgomery and Miller has to be a subject of our analysis in this case, when Husky, standing alone, might very well provide a new sentencing hearing for this defendant. So wherever you want to deal with it, fine, but deal with it.
The question's been asked. I think now is as good a time as any, Your Honor. As far as the Husky issue goes, I don't know that it necessarily needs to be. That's a freestanding issue in terms of fundamental fairness in the defense. The issue with Montgomery obviously was sort of spawned by the order this court entered directing supplemental briefing, but the neuropsychologist issue is a brand new issue, at least at this level, because it was petition denied on that point earlier. So I think the short answer to your question is you do that analysis basically the same way it's always been done in terms of whether there was an abuse of discretion. And I do think if Montgomery and Miller are sort of the parameters as to why you get this person, that perhaps plays some role. But I agree with the court that that's somewhat a freestanding issue.
Well, Mr. Drury said that he's not sure that it's his job to define the line. Well, he may be right about that. It's our job, and I think we did it in Husky. I mean, the Husky case demonstrates we hold that an indigent defendant who seeks the appointment of an expert witness at the Commonwealth's expense must demonstrate that the subject with necessitates the assistance of the expert is likely to be a significant factor in his defense, and that he will be prejudiced by the lack of expert assistance. On this case, without considering Montgomery or Miller, and understanding that counsel submitted to the court a multitude of authorities in the medical field as to why a neuropsychologist was important to this defendant's case, why can't we deal with this case by remanding only on Husky, but allowing a new sentencing hearing altogether?
Oh, I think you could deal with it that way, Your Honor. I think that that is certainly a path that you could take. The next question, obviously, is why don't you do that here?
Right, and that's a fair question. And
prepared
that's why
answer,
you're there.
Prepared to answer your last question.
All right.
Okay. First of all, you also said along the way, and I've cited all these cases in my brief, the fact that it might help. You know, is not enough. A conclusory proffer is not enough. I mean, we did have the indication, and obviously, in fairness to Mr. Drury, I know he had what he had. He was able to talk to a neuropsychologist who told him that there was something else going on inside the defendant's head. Porter says that the information has to materially assist. And I think, you know, a big part of this argument, yes, the social science studies, which of course are outlined in Miller and Montgomery, or Miller at least was before the trial court, Montgomery was not, you know, the court talked about some of those things. I think what the social science studies help elucidate here. It's not so much the what, it's the it gives you some flesh on the bones as to the why. But I think you have to remember, when you're looking at this under an abuse of discretion standard, a couple of things that I think you need to think about. One of the things is that the Commonwealth conceded here, it is a matter of common sense that youth is more impulsive time. But I'd like you to take a closer, because I didn't focus in on this until I was getting ready for this argument. It certainly isn't in my brief. Take a look at these studies, and I'll point you to about pages 110 to 122. It's not very long. But when you get down to the why, I highlighted some of this, and I hate to read from the lectern, but I think it's a good time to do it in this case. There's a lot of explanation of the what. And I think, as the prosecutor said, there are a lot of things here that are common sense in terms of youth, particularly somebody here. I think we'd all agree, to use Mr. Ruri's term at trial, there was something going on. Any youth that commits this type of a crime, there's something going on inside his head. It's a violent, nasty crime. But what's listed in these studies, ultimately, that the trial judge was told, you need an expert to amplify this for you, is... with an adolescent, there's behaviors such as self-absorption, a need for privacy, mood swings, unique dress, escapism, video games, music, talking on the phone, risky behaviors such as drug use or sexual activity. That's at page 110. Again, more at 112 about risk-seeking, risk-taking, thrill-seeking behaviors. At page 113, which to me was a prime example of why you don't necessarily need an expert to unpack this for you, and at a more significant level, why a trial judge wouldn't necessarily abuse his discretion to say, I don't need an expert to help me with this. I was sort of listening during the last argument when you were talking about abuse of discretion. Could I stand at the lectern and say that the court got it wrong having a neuropsychologist, notwithstanding what the questions Justice Kelsey asked? I think the answer is probably no. There wouldn't be any error in doing that. I mean, you go to page 113, and we've got a discussion of hot cognition versus cold cognition. And what's basically explained here in this article is that an adolescent behind the wheel of a car with four of his friends and blaring music and a need for speed is going to behave differently than an adolescent sitting at the wheel of a car with a driver's education instructor. Well, again, I don't think it's an abuse of discretion for a trial judge to say, look, you've asked me to expend funds, and this court has said this before, and I totally agree with what the trial judge said. Look, if fundamental fairness requires it, the cost really doesn't matter. And I'm not going to read you the rest of the things that I highlighted here because I could go on for a few more pages of that. But that's the type of things that this trial judge was asked to appoint an expert to explain to him. And, I suppose if the empirical studies were somehow got to a counterintuitive thing, that for some reason adolescents actually act more mature than adults or something like that, maybe you've got that need for an expert. But this court said in Duncan, and I'm going to paraphrase, but essentially it was, you don't abandon all common sense when you enter a courtroom as a fact finder. And I suggest to you that when the trial judge looked at this, he said to himself, look, marshal the facts that you have that would sort of support this. And one of the things that is in here is, absence of a male role model and issues with mom and drug abuse, those actually were injected at sentencing. And some of those type of things are covered in these studies. But again, I don't think this is like a cardiac surgeon coming and explaining heart surgery to somebody. The trial judge was certainly within his discretion to say, go ahead and marshal your facts, make your arguments. Everything here is a matter of common sense, as the prosecutor has already stipulated. And that's why I think even under the pure Husky analysis, this claim fails.
Right now, I'm sure that some of my colleagues will wonder what your thoughts are on Miller and Montgomery, because your position is it doesn't require a resentencing. You might want to direct your concerns to that question.
Okay. Angel is, at this point, still good law, and I think this court's probably aware that issue is percolating in the federal courts as we speak. But at this point, two things. Angel is still good binding precedent in this court. I mean, obviously, you can revisit Angel. I don't think you've been asked to do that. I would point out that even as recently as Montgomery, that the U.S. Supreme Court, in that opinion, actually cited as an example of something that would provide a meaningful opportunity for release a Wyoming statute, which has a 25-year trigger, which admittedly is a shorter duration than that at issue in our geriatric parole statute. But I think the U.S. Supreme Court at this point obviously has contemplated that the meaningful opportunity for release can be satisfied by some type of parole statute. Now, obviously, and I don't think I'm telling the court anything that you don't already know, the U.S. Supreme Court has not weighed in yet on our geriatric parole statute specifically, or frankly, anything that I could completely analogize to our geriatric parole statute. So at this point, I suppose that's still an open question, but I, again, in Montgomery, the court has contemplated that we can satisfy that, as this court has already said, with our geriatric statute, or something similar to it, I should say. I think that that really is the answer to this question. Angel is still controlling. I was going to talk about the concurrence, but I think Justice Mims beat me to the punch on that. The concurrence in Vasquez, as far as what these empirical studies are with respect to the operation of our geriatric statute mean or don't mean, and I don't think at this point that really adds anything significant to the mix. So that's really my answer to that. You know, I would point out, if I've answered your question fully, Your Honor, I would point out, and again, I'm not going to cite you a bunch of statutes and case law, but certainly under both our evidentiary rules and under federal constitutional principles, the court doesn't have to allow for evidence or testimony, back to the neuropsychologist issue, that's either irrelevant, cumulative, more prejudicial than probative. I don't think that's so much of an issue here. But that's covered both under our rules and under the federal constitution. Again, I can give you citations for that if you'd like. And I think that I'm going to close with on that issue that you have repeatedly said, and you said it in Husky, in fact, I think that's where you addressed the issue for the first time, there does have to be a showing of prejudice. And I think really for all the same reasons that I said that it was an abuse of discretion, that ultimately it would be very difficult, and my position is impossible, to show prejudice under these facts. And I think the same factors come into play, the things that I said about the types of studies and those things, I think that all is equally applicable to your prejudice analysis. Unless the court has further questions, I'd ask that you affirm the judgment of the Court of Appeals.
Thank you very much. Call the next.
The order that indicates that Judge Johnson entered that there are no viable bases upon which an attorney could have successfully pursued any motion to suppress. The Attorney General references that there is no, or makes an argument that there is, that this is procedurally defaulted. I would respectfully disagree. If you look at page 507 of the appendix, Mr. Witt explained there that he was never advised of his rights and that he was prejudiced as a result of statements that he had. I don't think there can be any real debate about whether or not his statement should have been suppressed or could have been suppressed. I think that that motion certainly would have had merit. He was in custody. The evidence was that he was arrested, that he was then asked questions about why he was reaching for whatever he was reaching for, and that the evidence admitted at trial that there was no warning percent of Miranda errors.
Can we get to prejudice then?
I think, yes, sir, and I think that the way we need to